labor, land, and the machinery question. Why the classical definition of wealth still holds in the age of AI. A reader fluent in 21st century economics will reasonably object that the framework's foundational definition of wealth appears anachronistic. The classical formulation, wealth as material things with exchange value, the result of labor applied to land, was developed in an era when agriculture, mining, manufacturing, and craft production dominated the economy, and when human labor was the irreducible production input that all other factors required. In 2026, much of the value being created is knowledge-based, information mediated or generated by AI systems that require no direct human labor at the point of production. The largest corporations in the world by market capitalization derive most of their value from intangible assets, software platforms, data networks, AI models, intellectual property that bear no obvious resemblance to grain or lumber. If this is the actual structure of the modern economy, the objection runs, what work can a definition rooted in agricultural industrial production still do? The objection is serious and deserves direct engagement. It is the kind of question a thoughtful reader of this catalog will inevitably encounter, and the framework's intellectual honesty requires confronting it openly rather than relying on readers not to notice the gap. The catalog's prior installments, the Dossier Economy Analysis, Article 30, the Labor Saleability Inversion, Article 28, the AI Compute as Nascent Real Bills Argument, Article 5, the Cryptographic Marketability Premium Analysis, Article 6, have all implicitly engaged this terrain without making the foundational defense explicit. This essay is that defense. The argument proceeds in four sections. First, the classical definition was never an inventory of what exists in the economy. It was always a diagnostic test for distinguishing real wealth from claims on wealth. And the lineage from Smith through Ricardo, George, Menger, and Piketty confirms this. Second, the digital economy still sits on a substantial physical substrate of natural resources, energy, and human labor that the classical framework can still read with precision. Third, the harder question, what political economy looks like when capital can structurally substitute for human labor, has been engaged by the classical tradition for over two centuries. Beginning with David Ricardo's remarkable 1821 reversal in Chapter XXXI of his Principles. Fourth, the framework's 2026 reading combines these three threads into a single analytical posture that is, in fact, more necessary now than it has been in living memory. The classical definition is not obsolete. It is the indispensable diagnostic for an economy whose substrate fragility has accumulated beyond what mainstream economic thinking is structurally equipped to perceive. The definition has always been a test, not an inventory. The first move requires distinguishing between two different things a definition might be doing. A definition can be descriptive, an attempt to enumerate or characterize what exists. The taxonomic definitions in biology operate this way. A definition of mammal is meant to capture the actual class of organisms in the world that share certain features. Descriptive definitions are evaluated by how well they map onto the underlying reality, and they become obsolete when the underlying reality changes faster than the definition can be updated. A definition can also be diagnostic, a test applied to phenomena to determine which category they belong to. The legal definition of fraud operates this way. It provides criteria that any specific commercial transaction can be evaluated against, with the diagnostic function of distinguishing legitimate trade from criminal conduct. Diagnostic definitions are not evaluated by inventory comprehensiveness. They are evaluated by analytical traction, by whether they let the user see distinctions that would otherwise remain invisible. The classical definition of wealth in the political economy tradition is, and has always been, a diagnostic definition. This is the central interpretive move that the framework operates on, and the lineage supporting it is substantial. Adam Smith, writing The Wealth of Nations in 1776, was not attempting an inventory of all British commercial activity in his definitional moves. He was developing a diagnostic apparatus for distinguishing productive economic activity, which generates wealth in the genuine sense, from unproductive activity, which redistributes existing wealth, without adding to it, and from outright illusion, which trades as if it were wealth but is structurally counterfeit. Smith's critique of mercantilist gold hoarding of monopoly trading companies, of unproductive court patronage, and of speculative bubbles all rested on this diagnostic apparatus. The labor-to-land formulation was the foundation of the test, not a description of the economy as it existed. David Ricardo, writing On the Principles of Political Economy and Taxation in 1817, sharpened the diagnostic further. Ricardo's labor theory of value was explicitly developed as a tool for distinguishing the natural prices of commodities determined by their underlying production costs in labor terms. From there, market prices, which could fluctuate substantially due to short-term factors, and for analyzing how the distribution of national income among landowners, capitalists, and laborers would evolve over time. Ricardo was not claiming that every commercial transaction in 1817 England involved direct application of labor to land. He was claiming that the labor to land foundation provided the diagnostic structure within which the actual complexity of commercial life could be analyzed. Henry George, writing Progress and Poverty in 1879, made the diagnostic explicit. George opened with a sentence that names the problem. This association of poverty with progress is the great enigma of our times. Why does technological progress and economic expansion fail to alleviate poverty? Why does increasing wealth-producing power coexist with persistent destitution among the laboring classes? George's answer required applying the classical diagnostic to a specific question of the wealth being created by industrial progress, who actually captures it. His conclusion, that landowners capture a disproportionate share through rising rents on a fixed natural substrate, was only possible because he was using the labor-to-land formulation as a diagnostic tool rather than as an inventory. The diagnostic let him see what mainstream economic thinking of his era could not perceive. That the gains from technological progress were not flowing primarily to labor or to capital, but to the holders of the underlying natural substrate that all production required. Karl Menger's Principles of Economics, 1871 and On the Origins of Money, 1892, operate through a different specific theoretical apparatus, but employ the same diagnostic posture. Menger's Salability Spectrum, the analytical framework for understanding why certain commodities sort into monetary roles while others do not, depends on the underlying distinction between goods that have actual economic value rooted in their utility for satisfying human needs in conditions of scarcity, and what Menger called imaginary goods, which subjects believe have value but which lack the underlying economic foundation that the salability spectrum would reveal. Antal Fekete, writing throughout the late 20th and early 21st centuries, took the diagnostic posture to its fullest development. Fekete's central project was understanding how the fiat monetary system after 1971 substituted notes for the underlying wealth claims those notes were originally meant to represent. His analytical apparatus, the gold basis, real bills doctrine, capital erosion through open market operations, the analysis of substrate fragility in central bank balance sheets, depended throughout on the classical wealth definition as the diagnostic against which substitute layer phenomena could be identified. Fekete's essays, Red Alert, Gold Backwardation, 2008, The Prize-Winning Wither Gold, 1996, and the broader body of his work would be unintelligible without the underlying diagnostic apparatus the classical definition provides. The lineage is consistent. The labor-to-land formulation has functioned as a diagnostic test across the classical tradition for 2.5 centuries, used by every major figure in the lineage to distinguish real wealth from claims on wealth, to identify substitute layer phenomena, and to analyze where in the broader economy the gains from production are actually flowing. The definition's value has never been its inventory comprehensiveness. Its value has always been the analytical traction it provides, the ability to see distinctions that would otherwise remain invisible to the analyst working with the categories that ordinary commercial discourse provides. The framework operates within this tradition explicitly. The definition is doing diagnostic work, not descriptive work. The question to ask is not, does this definition capture everything that exists in the 2026 economy? But does this definition allow us to identify the structural patterns we need to identify? The catalog's prior 30 essays have demonstrated repeatedly and across multiple sectors that the answer is yes. Land has always been broader than dirt. The second objection embedded in thee is this definition obsolete? Question is more specific. Even granting that the definition is diagnostic, the objection might continue, the diagnostic still requires the existence of underlying labor to land production for the test to operate. If the 2026 economy has substantially decoupled from the natural substrate, if value is now created through software, data, AI, and intangible assets that don't seem to require either labor or land in any meaningful sense, then the diagnostic itself becomes vacuous. The test would have nothing to diagnose because nothing in the modern economy would qualify as the underlying production the test is calibrated against. This objection rests on a substantial misunderstanding of what the classical tradition has always meant by land, and addressing it requires returning to the actual usage in the source texts. In the classical political economy tradition, land was never restricted to agricultural acreage. The term referred to the full natural substrate on which production operates, what economists and philosophers have variously called natural resources, the natural environment, the gifts of nature, or, in more contemporary terminology, the biophysical foundation of economic activity. For Smith, land included not just farmland, but mines, forests, fisheries, water sources, harbors, and the broader natural endowments of a country. For Ricardo, land was the source of differential rent for any natural resource whose supply was effectively fixed and whose productivity varied. For George, land included all natural opportunities, mineral deposits, urban locations, radio spectrum, in later Georgist analysis, atmospheric carbon capacity, and any other gift of nature that human beings could not produce, but could appropriate. The classical land concept has always been broad enough to encompass the full natural substrate of economic activity. This breadth matters substantially when the classical definition is applied to the 2026 digital economy. Consider what the digital economy actually rests on. Server farms require physical land for the buildings, electricity for the computation, and substantial water for cooling. Electricity generation requires either natural gas extracted from underground, coal mined from the ground, nuclear fuel mined and processed from uranium-bearing ore, solar panels manufactured from rare earth elements and silicon mined from the ground, wind turbines manufactured from steel, copper, and rare earth elements, or hydroelectric infrastructure built on rivers, which are themselves natural features of the landscape. Each of these production chains terminates in extraction from the natural substrate. The cloud, that euphemistic term for the digital infrastructure underlying contemporary commercial life, is a marketing metaphor that obscures the substantial physical reality of the systems involved. AI compute specifically depends on a particularly demanding physical infrastructure. The semiconductor fabs that produce the GPUs used for training large language models require extraordinarily clean facilities, in some cases, the cleanest manufacturing environments ever constructed in. Human history, pure water in volumes that affect regional water tables, electricity loads that can require their own dedicated generation capacity, and rare earth elements whose global supply chains are subject to substantial geopolitical concentration. The training process itself, for a frontier AI model, consumes electricity in quantities comparable to the annual consumption of small cities, with the associated emissions and resource draw that this implies. The deployment infrastructure, data centers operating at scale to serve inference requests, represents one of the largest current sources of new electricity demand in the United States and is reshaping the U.S. power grid in real time. The framework's Article 5, AI compute as nascent real bills, engaged this dimension explicitly. AI compute, in framework terms, is the closest 2026 analog to what Fichte identified as real bills in the classical sense. Short-term commercial paper representing genuine production activity that is consumed and produced on similar timescales. The compute itself is genuinely produced through labor applied to land in the classical sense. Engineers, technicians, fabricators, electricians, energy workers, miners, and operations staff applying their labor to physical inputs derived from the natural substrate. When the catalog reads AI compute as productive activity in the classical sense, it is not making a metaphorical claim. It is making a literal one. The labor and the substrate are both present and both classical. What is not classical, what represents a departure from the underlying production base and into the substitute layer territory the framework is calibrated to identify, is the valuation of AI labs at multiples that bear no plausible relationship to the productive infrastructure they actually operate. When Anthropic closes a $65 billion round at a $965 billion valuation in late May 2026, and OpenAI carries roughly $852 billion after raising some $122 billion in the first quarter, the two of them absorbing about 43% of all startup funding in the first half of the year. The gap between the productive substrate and the financial claims is exactly the kind of substrate fragility phenomenon the classical diagnostic was designed to identify. The classical definition is not obsolete in this analysis. It is doing precisely the diagnostic work it was developed to do. The labor and the land are present. The claims that exceed them are the substitute layer artifacts. The analytical move generalizes. Software companies whose valuations depend substantially on speculative assessment of future user growth rather than on current production. Cryptocurrency tokens whose market capitalizations exceed any plausible measure of underlying transaction utility. Social media platforms whose advertising revenues are sustained by user attention generated through carefully designed engagement mechanisms whose connection to actual production is mediated through extensive substitute layer infrastructure. In each case, the classical definition does not need to be updated to accommodate the modern economy. The classical definition lets us read the modern economy more accurately than the modern economy reads itself. The natural substrate is still there, doing the underlying productive work. The substitute layer artifacts are still there, trading at scale on the basis of the substrate's productive capacity while bearing no necessary relationship to it. A 2026 reader genuinely engaged with the analytical project of the classical tradition would not be puzzled by the question of whether the definition still applies. The reader would recognize the definition as the indispensable tool for understanding what is actually happening in an economy whose substitute layer development has reached unprecedented sophistication. The harder question, when capital substitutes for labor itself the deepest version of the I, is this definition obsolete? Objection comes when the discussion turns to AI's potential to substitute for human labor across substantial sectors of the economy. If AI capital can perform productive work that previously required human labor, the objection runs the classical labor applied to land. Formulation may break down at a more fundamental level. Not because the land disappears, but because the labor does. What does the definition tell us when capital that does not require labor can produce wealth on its own? This is the genuinely hard question, and the framework needs to engage it with full intellectual seriousness. The good news, for purposes of defending the classical tradition, is that this question is not new. It has been engaged by the classical tradition for over two centuries, beginning with one of the most remarkable intellectual reversals in the history of economic thought. In 1817, when David Ricardo published the first edition of On the Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, his analysis of machinery was substantially optimistic. Machinery, he argued, expanded productive capacity, lowered prices for consumers, and benefited all classes, landowners, capitalists, and laborers alike. The compensation principle, as it later came to be called, held that any short-term displacement of labor by machinery would be offset by the expanded production the machinery enabled, generating new employment in adjacent activities. This position was consistent with the mainstream of classical political economy at the time and with Ricardo's general theoretical apparatus. 4 years later, in the third edition of Principles, 1821, Ricardo added a new chapter, Chapter XXI, titled On Machinery. That reversed his prior position with a candor unusual in the history of economic thought. The chapter opens by announcing the subject. In the present chapter, I shall enter into some inquiry respecting the influence of machinery on the interests of the different classes of society, a subject of great importance, and one which appears never to have been investigated in a manner to lead to any certain and satisfactory results. The second sentence is the one worth quoting in full, and its "they" refers to those opinions. It is more incumbent on me to declare my opinion on this question, because they have, on further reflection, undergone a considerable change. And although I am not aware that I have ever published anything respecting machinery which it is necessary for me to retract, yet I have in other ways given my support to doctrines which I now think erroneous. It, therefore, becomes a duty in me to submit my present views to examination, with my reasons for entertaining them. Ricardo then proceeded to articulate, in concrete arithmetical detail, the structural mechanism by which machinery could permanently displace labor without the displaced workers being absorbed elsewhere in the economy. His specific argument, if a capitalist converts circulating capital, which is paid out in wages, supporting workers' consumption, into fixed capital, which embodies machinery, supporting no workers' consumption, the gross product of the economy declines even as the net product, the surplus available to capitalists, may increase or remain constant. The displaced workers do not find new employment because there is no expansion of gross product to support new employment. The same net output is being produced with less labor. And the workers, whose labor is no longer required, have no automatic claim on the new technological surplus. In a private letter to John Ramsay McCulloch dated June 18, 1821, in Sraffa's edition of The Works and Correspondence, Volume 8, which covers the letters of 1819 through June 1821, Ricardo extended the analysis to its logical extreme. I have said that when a manufacturer is in possession of a circulating capital, he can employ with it a greater number of men. And if it should suit his purposes to substitute a fixed capital of an equal value for this circulating capital, it will be inevitably followed by a necessity for dismissing a part of his workmen. And in another private letter of the same year, in Ricardo's own spelling, if machinery could do all the work that labor now does, there would be no demand for labor. Acemoglu and Johnson, who take Ricardo's reversal as the historical anchor for the AI displacement question, cite the line from Sraffa at page 159. Ricardo had personally witnessed the consequences of mechanization in the textile industry during his tenure on the Select Committee on the Poor Laws, to which he was named on entering the House of Commons in 1819, his maiden speech that March on the misapplication of poor rates, already turned on overpopulation, and inadequate wages. The power looms in cotton manufacturing produced output that had previously required substantial hand-loom weaver labor, and the displaced weavers were not finding their way back into productive employment at the wages they had previously commanded. Ricardo's reversal was not abstract theorizing. It was a careful empirical observer, updating his analytical position in light of evidence that contradicted his prior theoretical commitments. The intellectual honesty involved is exemplary. Classical tradition continued engaging the machinery question after Ricardo. Karl Marx, writing Capital in 1867, developed Ricardo's analysis into a more systematic theoretical apparatus. Marx's concept of the organic composition of capital, the ratio of constant capital, machinery, raw materials, fixed inputs, to variable capital, the wage fund employing labor, captured exactly the dynamic Ricardo had identified, generalized to a theory of capitalist development as a whole. As capitalism develops, Marx argued, the organic composition tends to rise. Production becomes more capital-intensive, less labor-intensive, with each successive technological generation reducing the relative role of human labor in the production process. Marx drew two conclusions from this trajectory that are directly relevant to the 2026 AI question. First, the rising organic composition tended, all else equal, to depress the rate of profit, because, in Marx's labor theory of value framework, only labor produced, surplus value, rising capital intensity meant a falling ratio of profit-generating labor to total invested capital. Second, the rising organic composition would generate what Marx called a relative surplus population, a growing reserve of workers whose labor was no longer required by the production process and who would consequently exist at the margins of the labor market, available for occasional employment but structurally unable to find stable productive roles. Both predictions, whatever their specific theoretical limitations within Marx's framework, identified empirically observable trajectories in 19th century European industrial capitalism. Henry George, working from a different theoretical position, identified the same structural dynamic and traced it to a different ultimate cause. The opening of progress and poverty is structured around the association of poverty with progress that George called the great enigma of our times. The persistent coexistence of advancing economic productivity and deepening poverty among the laboring classes. George's diagnostic applied to this enigma located the cause not in capital labor dynamics directly, but in the underlying ownership of land. As technological progress expanded productive capacity, George argued, the gains were captured disproportionately by landowners through rising rents on the natural substrate that all production required. The labor share of productivity gains was systematically reduced by the rising land rents that absorbed the gains before they could reach workers. George's conclusion, political liberty, when the equal right to land is denied, becomes, as population increases and invention goes on, merely the liberty to compete for employment at starvation wages. The classical tradition, in summary, had a more sophisticated engagement with the machinery question than mainstream contemporary discussion of AI displacement typically credits it with. Ricardo identified the structural mechanism by which machinery could displace labor without compensation. Marx generalized this into a theory of capitalist development. George identified the role of land ownership in capturing the technological gains. These analyses were developed across a 60-year period in response to the most economically consequential technological transition in human history to that point, the transition from craft production to industrial machinery. The analyses were taken seriously by their authors, were defended in detail, and were grounded in empirical observation of the affected workforce. What does this tradition tell us about the 2026 AI question? The framework's reading, the AI substitution dynamic, is structurally analogous to the machinery dynamic. Ricardo identified in 1821, operating at substantially greater scale and with substantially shorter compensation timelines, but through the same essential mechanism, the labor-to-wealth pathway that has historically been the primary channel for distributing the gains from productive activity is being compressed for substantial portions of the workforce. The Cantillon distributional effect identified in the catalog's prior installments, where productivity gains flow disproportionately to capital holders, AI capability suppliers, and workers whose labor complements rather than substitutes for AI, is the contemporary manifestation of the structural pattern Ricardo, Marx, and George each identified in their respective historical contexts. The classical wealth definition does not break down under this analysis. It does diagnostic work that is, if anything, more critical now than in any previous period. The diagnostic identifies precisely where the labor-to-wealth pathway is being compressed, where the gains are flowing instead, and which institutional structures are mediating the distributional shift. The framework's prior work on labor saleability, Article 28, and on the dossier economy, Article 30, operates within exactly this classical analytical tradition. Both essays apply the diagnostic to specific 2026 phenomena. Both essays reach conclusions that are continuous with the classical tradition's prior engagement with comparable transitions. The harder version of the question, what does political economy prescribe when capital can structurally substitute for labor at scale, is a different question than the diagnostic one. The framework does not advocate specific political programs. The framework documents structural conditions and makes them visible. But the diagnostic itself remains operative regardless of which prescriptive conclusions are drawn from it. The classical tradition's engagement with the machinery question gives us the tools to see what is happening. What to do about what we see is a different essay, one the catalog may eventually produce, but which depends on the diagnostic clarity this essay is establishing. The 2026 synthesis. The threads developed across the previous three sections combine into a single analytical posture that the framework operates from explicitly. First, the classical definition of wealth, material things with exchange value, the result of labor applied to land, is and has always been a diagnostic test rather than an inventory of economic activity. Its value lies in the analytical traction it provides, in the distinctions it lets the user see that would otherwise remain invisible. Second, the land, in the classical formulation, encompasses the full natural substrate of economic activity, not just agricultural acreage. The 2026 digital economy sits on this substrate substantially through energy generation, mineral extraction, semiconductor manufacturing, water consumption, and the broader physical infrastructure that all digital activity requires. The framework can read where production is genuinely occurring and where substitute layer claims exceed the underlying productive base. Third, The classical tradition has been engaging the question of capital labor substitution for over two centuries, beginning with Ricardo's 1821 reversal and continuing through Marx's organic composition of capital and George's analysis of how technological progress is captured by land monopoly. The 2026 AI substitution dynamic is structurally continuous with this prior history, operating at greater scale and shorter timescales, but through the same essential mechanism. The framework's specific 2026 reading combines these three threads. The labor share of national income in the United States has been declining since approximately 1980. Some measures date the turn to the 1960s. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics data show roughly three-quarters of the entire post-1947 decline occurring between 2000 and 2016. It stood at 53.8% in the third quarter of 2025. And BLS figures released in January 2026 put the labor share of GDP at its lowest level since the series began in 1947. That the current record low is being driven by AI capability deployment is the framework's reading rather than an established finding. The standard explanations in the literature are technological change, globalization, market concentration, and declining union bargaining power. And disentangling AI from the first of those is not yet possible in the data. What the framework does claim is that the structural pattern is the one Ricardo identified in 1821, Marx generalized in 1867. And George located in land monopoly in 1879. The classical definition lets us see this pattern with precision. The labor-to-wealth pathway is being compressed. The gains are flowing to specific institutional holders of the underlying productive substrate, AI labs, semiconductor manufacturers, energy producers, data center operators, and the capital pools financing each of these. The dossier economy, Article 30, is one specific manifestation of this broader dynamic in which the underlying production, human existence in digital environments, is being captured by aggregators, whose ownership of the aggregation infrastructure allows them to monetize the production without the producers participating in the value capture. The substitute layer artifacts in 2026 are particularly elaborate. Financial valuations of AI labs, social media platforms, cryptocurrency tokens, and data brokerage entities trade at multiples that bear varying relationships to the underlying productive substrate of each. The classical diagnostic lets us see where the underlying production is, where the substitute layers operate, and where the gap between the two has become structurally consequential. The framework's prior essays on agency MBS. Article 8, the cryptographic marketability premium. Article 6, the salability of Bitcoin. Article 13, stablecoins and CBDCs. Article 15, the silver paper physical decoupling. Article 24, the Iran crypto seizures. Article 25, the Hormuz propagation timeline. Article 26, and the commercial real estate collapse. Article 27, all apply the diagnostic to specific substitute layer phenomena in different sectors. The pattern across these essays is consistent. In each case, the classical definition allows the framework to read the structural reality more accurately than the dominant commercial discourse does. The political economy implications follow from the diagnostic without requiring the framework to advocate specific prescriptive programs. When the labor-to-wealth pathway is structurally compressed, distributional consequences accumulate. Real wages stagnate or decline across substantial portions of the workforce. The labor share of national income falls. Wealth concentration accelerates. The political economic conditions that historically supported broad middle-class participation in productive prosperity erode. These are the same consequences that the 19th century classical tradition identified in its engagement with industrial mechanization, manifesting now in different specific institutional forms, but operating through the same structural mechanism. The framework's job is to make this visible. The prescriptive question of what to do about it is a separate intellectual project, one that the catalog may eventually engage, but which depends on the diagnostic clarity being established here. The closing observation. The classical definition of wealth has not become obsolete in 2026. It has become indispensable. Mainstream contemporary economics has largely abandoned the classical political economy tradition in favor of formalist, marginalist approaches that, whatever their analytical sophistication in narrow applications, are structurally ill-equipped to perceive substrate fragility phenomena. The dominant frameworks of contemporary policy analysis cannot easily see where production is genuinely occurring versus where substitute layer claims are trading. They cannot easily distinguish the productive base of an economy from the financial superstructure operating on top of it. They cannot easily identify when distributional dynamics are compressing the labor-to-wealth pathway in ways that will produce political consequences years or decades after the initial mechanism began operating. The classical tradition could see these things. The framework project is to recover what the classical tradition was always able to see and apply it to 2026 conditions with the same intellectual seriousness Smith brought to. Mercantilism, Ricardo brought to industrial mechanization, Marx brought to capitalist development, George brought to land monopoly, Menger brought to monetary origins, and Fekete brought to the post-1971 fiat regime. The recovery is necessary because the substitute layer development of the post-2008 monetary architecture, combined with the AI substitution dynamic of the 2020s, has produced an economy whose structural conditions cannot be adequately read with the analytical tools that mainstream contemporary economics provides. The classical tradition is not a quaint historical artifact. It is the operational toolkit for understanding what is actually happening. This essay has argued three things in support of the framework's foundational position. The classical definition has always been diagnostic rather than inventorial, and the lineage from Smith through Fekete is consistent on this point. The land, in the classical formulation, encompasses the full natural substrate of economic activity, and the 2026 digital economy still rests substantially on that substrate. The classical tradition has been engaging the capital-labor substitution question for over two centuries, beginning with Ricardo's 1821 reversal. And the framework's 2026 engagement with AI labor substitution is continuous with this prior intellectual history rather than departing from it. The objection that started this essay, that the classical definition is anachronistic in an age of digital and AI-mediated economic activity, has its answer. The definition is not anachronistic. It is the diagnostic test that lets us read what 2026 economic activity actually is, where the underlying production is occurring, where the substitute layer claims operate, and what the distributional consequences of the current configuration are likely to be. The mainstream commercial discourse cannot see these things clearly. The classical tradition can. The framework's job is to bring that classical analytical clarity to bear on contemporary conditions, essay by essay, sector by sector, with the discipline and intellectual honesty the tradition itself models across 2.5 centuries of accumulated work. The definition holds. The framework's foundational apparatus is intact. The catalog will continue building on this foundation as additional sectors produce additional empirical material for the diagnostic to engage. The work continues. This is the 7th installment of Series 1, the New Austrian Economics Catalog's foundational theoretical thread. The first 6 Series 1 essays, Articles 1-6, establish the framework's core analytical apparatus through specific 2026 applications, Gold's response to the Hormuz disruption, the Hormuzian toll as a Mengerian event, the decay function of marketability, capital destruction through open market operations, AI compute as nascent real bills, and the cryptographic marketability premium. This 7th essay returns to the framework's foundational definitions to defend them against the obvious objection that they appear anachronistic in 2026 conditions. The defense rests on the classical tradition's own intellectual history, particularly Ricardo's 1821 reversal in chapter XXXI of his Principles, Marx's analysis of organic composition of capital, and George's diagnostic in Progress and Poverty, and on the framework's prior applied work demonstrating the definition's continued analytical traction across multiple 2026 sectors. A forthcoming Series 1 installment will engage the prescriptive question of what the diagnostic implies for political economy in conditions of structurally compressed labor-to-wealth pathways. Ricardo's machinery question, updated for the AI era, taken to its policy, relevant conclusion.